Hey everyone, and welcome to High Performance Pathways Season 2, Episode Number 10. I'm your host, Court Whitman. Now, today's podcast is brought to you by the Notecast app, and you can find this app in Apple Store and Google Play. And if you enjoy this podcast, please consider more about me at courtwhitman.com. For all those new listeners out there, High Performance Pathways is a purpose-built and specially selected collection of someone's experience as they discuss how they understand, discover, and chase high performance in their own life. This content is collected during a one-on-one interview and then shared with you. Why? Because I believe everyone has a different path to high performance, and hearing about the paths that other professionals have journeyed along is informative and it's inspiring. So, during each episode of High Performance Pathways, it is my intent to do five things for you, the listener. Number one, connect. Connect you to someone else to build relationships. Number two, question to understand. Number three, share to raise perspective. Number four, teach to increase competence. And number five, inspire to trigger your growth as a listener. One additional note to cover as you continue listening. This podcast is raw, meaning there's no post-production editing. We record live and deliver it to you exactly as it was recorded. Now, my guest today is John McCaskill. John is a retiring Navy SEAL commander who is guiding veterans to a sense of peace, acceptance, transformation, and honor by introducing them to the life-changing practices of meditation and mindfulness. You see, after 20 years as both an enlisted sailor and a commissioned U.S. Navy SEAL officer, John served in a number of challenging assignments. And in John's own words, he considers himself, and I quote here, blessed. Blessed to serve with some of the greatest men and women in the world. Blessed. Blessed to see places and do things most of us only read or dream about. Blessed. Blessed to have served his country and defend his fellow Americans, end quote. You see, John also serves as the Deputy Executive Director and CFO for Veterans Path. And Veterans Path is a nonprofit helping veterans discover and rediscover meaning, purpose, and joy through mindfulness, meditation, and safe community. See, there's a small theme here that you're kind of listening to. We're going to talk quite a bit today with my guest about mindfulness and meditation and its impact upon performance. So, let me continue here a little bit more about my friend John. John is also the owner of McCaskill Consulting, where he serves as a mindfulness teacher, certified in that particular competency, and dedicated in his work to optimizing individuals and organizations through mindfulness and meditation. You see, John also plays an active role in a number of veteran support organizations, to include as a fellow at the Honor Foundation, as a local coordinator for Elite Meat, as a member of the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum, and John serves as a board member for Trails of Purpose. And Trails of Purpose is a 501(c) located in Hampton Roads, Virginia, and operates as a certified professional association of Therapeutic Horsemanship International Center. John's also a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy, the Naval Postgraduate School, in the Tuck Next Step School of Business at Dartmouth, which is a two-week course tailored to helping veterans and elite athletes through their transition experiences. John, I'm thrilled to have you here, man. Nobody else we'd love to spend this time with. I think you're going to be a gift to our audience, given what you've done and where you're focused now in your service to others. So thanks so much for just having this conversation around sport, around the Navy, around mindfulness and meditation, and overall really just your journey through life as you've been chasing high performance.
Court, brother, it's an absolute honor to be here with you today. I appreciate it, and I am completely humbled to be amongst the guests that you've had on the show. I looked at the guest list that you've had, and I've listened to some of the episodes that you've put out, and I am completely humbled to be amongst that high-performing crew. So thanks for the opportunity, brother.
Yeah, man. Love it. Glad that we're here. And I think it's interesting. You know, I tell people a lot that life moves around based upon relationship. And I heard that for a long time. And I don't know that I was, you know, drinking the Kool-Aid initially when I first heard it as a young man. But that's how the world goes these days. And you know, we're going on probably a year, at least a year and a half relationship. And so this is a bit long overdue, right? But it's because you're busy. I'm glad to have you here, man, because I think there's a lot you can share that can be helpful. And that's well aligned with my listening base, athletes in transition, veterans in transition. And I think life's a constant state of transition, to be honest. So it extends well into business. So super excited to have you here. I want to get rolling, man. Really going way back, if I may.
Sure. Yeah, man. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Want to talk about sport, if I may, and its impact on your development. So specifically, would you consider sharing some of your earliest memories of being a competitive athlete? And you know, what inspired you to join the Navy team as an enlisted soldier?
Yeah, man. Let me think. The athlete part, my earliest memory of that actually comes from South Africa, which is where I was born. And I only moved to the States when I was 7 years old. And I started in South Africa. Yeah, I sure did. I was born in Cape Town, moved to Johannesburg when I was like three or four. And then my parents, funny enough, moved us from South Africa when I was 7 years old to America for a number of reasons, one of which was to escape the draft, because my brother and myself would have been conscripted into the military when we were 18 years old in South Africa. Mm. So they brought us over here, and then I voluntarily joined the military, the U.S. military, you know, 11 years later. So yeah, crazy story there. My father brought us over initially on a 1 year working visa. Then we got green cards, and we never went home, or at least we never went home to stay. Obviously, we went home and visited a couple of times, and my parents have been back a whole lot, but I've only been back once, and that was when I was, I don't know, 10 or 11 years old. That's really kind of where my earliest athletic memories are, and they're going to be different probably than most of your listeners or most of your guests, in that it started with soccer, which may be similar to some of yours, but cricket as well. I started playing cricket when I was super young, and I was completely addicted to it.
Wow.
As a matter of fact, when I came over to the States and I realized that cricket wasn't a sport over here, or at least not in the South, and I still have yet to find it being played anywhere here in the U.S., I was pretty disappointed. So so I tried to make the transition to baseball, and I played baseball for a while. And I played basketball, and I played football, and I ran track, all that through like junior high. And then I hit, this crazy growth spurt, which was good for basketball as far as defense, but that crazy growth spurt, it kind of caused me to lose my coordination. So I ended up realizing that ball sports weren't my thing, because I wasn't that great with my shooting or catching skills anymore. So I ended up sticking with track, and I started running cross country, and track, I was running the kind of long distance stuff. And my coach in high school, and this is kind of gets to your question, and forgive me if I'm kind of long winded here, Court, but my coach in high school was like my second dad. And I still, to this day, I talk with him regularly, and I still seek out his guidance. And he had a truly profound impact on who I became and who I am to this day. And so did running, and so did that team that I was a part of. And the training that he put us through in high school was absolutely brutal. We went to these running camps in North Carolina. I grew up in Louisiana, and we'd go to these running camps in Brevard, North Carolina. You know, you probably know where Brevard is.
I do. Right down 95, so I believe, Brevard College.
Yeah, sure enough, that's where we'd go. We'd stay at Brevard College and then go running in the hills, and then afterwards, like all these other kids, would go back to the campus and you know, they would hang out and listen to their music or do whatever it was. I mean, this was the mid-90s, right? So we didn't have iPhones to go back and play on, but people would go back and just hang out. Whereas our coach would go to camp with us, and he would put us like in the cold streams to heal our legs up after these runs. And then he would start us as a pack after everybody else had started these runs. And he would have us count how many people we could catch during these runs. And they weren't like hard, or they weren't meant to be hard, like races or anything. They were just training runs, but he would turn them into races. And I think that brutal training, both the cold water and the everything is a competition always, I think that really helped to set me up for success later when I entered the Navy, and even later when I entered into the SEAL teams, or at least the training for the SEAL teams. But yeah, going back to the track and cross country, I mean, he would take us through cross country starting in like July. We'd start training, all the way through the end of the state track meet in November, take a couple weeks off, then start training for track in December, run all the way through until the end of the state track meet in like May, and then we'd take a couple weeks off. And so basically we would run for 11 months of the year, and we would run every day those 11 months. We ended up winning state twice in cross country. We were nationally ranked. In track, I was on the mile. I ran a mile and a 2 mile, and then I was on a relay team, the 4x800 meter relay. And that relay team, I mean, this was 1996. We still hold the school record for that. So what is that? 24 years later. But you know, my coach really helped to develop us into pretty awesome superstar runners. So I tell you all that because at a young age, sports definitely had a profound impact on who I became. And then that leads me kind of directly to what inspired me to join the Navy, and then more specifically the SEAL teams, because I'd been part of that small pack of guys. We were like a team of 8 or 9 on the cross country team and I don't know, like 25 or so on the track team. Anyway, I'd been part of that small, close-knit elite team in those amazing track and cross-country teams. We were like brothers. I mean, we hung out all the time. We partied together as much as you can party in high school. I mean, this is, again, the mid-90s in Louisiana, Ruston, Louisiana. So, you know, partying would be like going cow-tipping or whatever. So we would hang out and do everything together. And I wanted to find something like that, something small, something tight-knit, kind of a brotherhood who would do anything for one another. And I had, along with that, I had a deep desire to serve. So that's why I joined the military, and specifically the SEALs, was because it was kind of an elite group. And then why I chose the Navy over any other service was, quite honestly, I met with a recruiter. I told him I love the ocean, and he was like, well, if you join the Navy, you're always going to be by the water. And really that was all it took was, okay, well, I always want to be near the ocean. And pretty much since I started in 1996, I have been near the ocean almost my entire career, either the ocean or some major body of water, like Tampa. I was at Tampa Bay. So I guess that kind of counts as the ocean, but yeah, that's, my long-winded answer there, man. Sorry, I probably ran down several tangents.
No, it was an awesome reflection, man. And I'm just sitting here trying to think of how I can one-up the Navy in this moment, because I'm a damn Army guy, and I always fail. Because y'all knuckleheads always bring up where the heck your duty assignments are, and they're always incredible. I got nothing, man. You know, 96 to 2000, always been by the ocean, right? Who wants to sign up for that? Yep. Hey, man, the damn lion's wrapping around the building. You know, who wants to go hang out in the desert or the woods? Come join the Army. So a little bit laughable, but incredibly envious of the incredible duty assignments associated with naval service. So, and it seems like that was important to you, or something.
Yeah, it was.
So, hey, man, I just really want to shout out to the coaches out there that are listening. John talked about how formative that experience was for him. My high school football coaches, Richard Grissom, Tony Duncan, Perry Lloyd. I'm never going to forget them. They're high school football coaches. It was just years ago. But their impact upon my life has been significant and long-term. So, and also, shout out to the atypical approach to practice. Who's dunking their kids in freaking cold water? I mean, we know this now. I mean, I'm a former special operator guy. You are an active one still. The cold plunge is a real word in the human performance labs that we've been exposed to. You get done with your Metcon, you get done with your work, you got a freaking cold plunge in the locker room to go sit in for 10 minutes. Well, your coach was doing it in the 90s, and then I love the competition that he created and kind of just lit a fire in your home. Yeah, with his approach. And, by the way, and you got some freaking paperwork to prove it with the national rankings and the championships. So I do think there's some incredible birthplaces of just how you grow to be a person with those experiences with sport. So thanks for sharing yours. Continue here, man. Some incredible memories of sport there. What about the Navy? Aside from where you served, right? When you think about your time in the Navy, and I'm hopeful that you're doing some of this now. I would guess you're a pretty reflective man, just because I know you well and I know what kind of motivates you, but you're probably thinking a lot about your 20 plus years in the Navy, because you're moved towards retirement now. But anything you'd share right now from a memories place about your time in service with the Navy?
Yeah, man, we could have several hours of a show with that, but yeah, I'll hit you kind of with my top three. And number one was graduating the Naval Academy. And this is all Navy centric stuff. And, you know, then there's obviously personal memories that happened during my Navy career. You know, and I'll touch on those here in a second, but Navy centric during my Navy career was, well, number one, graduating from the Naval Academy. Number two, graduating from SEAL training, BUDS, basic underwater demolition, SEAL training, Coronado, and then finally getting pinned as a SEAL. And then number three was serving as a platoon commander. And as a platoon commander, I was directly in charge of some rough and tough men who were ready, and they were willing to serve with one another, but also die for one another if need be. Now that all said, like I mentioned, I had some other memories along the way. You know, getting married was the top memory, getting married in my service, traveling to Nepal with my wife, and then the birth of my two kids. And I, like you mentioned in the intro, I do consider myself super blessed, brother. I'm super thankful for my career in the Navy and then what the career in the Navy has afforded me as far as personal opportunities. I can't say enough about the time. I mean, sure, I had some tough times, I had some ups and downs, but all in all, I feel that I am completely blessed to have served alongside the men and women that I've served with, and then to have been given the opportunity to serve my country in the capacity that I did.
Absolutely, man. I have a similar sentiment, I think, when I reflect back on my service to the Army. And I don't know that I had a great appreciation of how developmental it all was when I was going through it. But now 3 years removed, it's been so informative to just my path, and just kind of how I view things, in a similar regard to kind of how you've just shared your gratitude there. Would like to really just tap into in this moment, if I could, put you on the spot for some advice, right?
Sure.
Advice for the listener out there that wants to be a Navy SEAL, because guess what? Everybody wants to be a Navy SEAL. They don't want, I mean, they do, man. I'm calling a spade a spade. I even did recruitment at one point in my career, you know, for Army Special Forces. And there's a quick story I'll tell you, man. I was at Fort Benning, Georgia, and I'm hopefully even a SEAL like you knows what Fort Benning is. But Fort Benning, for everyone listening, this is the home of the infantry, the Army infantry, Fort Benning, Georgia. And I was there at a Doubletree Hotel doing some recruiting there for Special Forces. And I just because this is the way I am, I had an early morning workout and I was just coming back from that and I didn't shower. And I jumped in the elevator and a couple businessmen got in there and I'm riding it up to my floor to get changed and then go off to do kind of my engagement. And the folks were looking at me and I said, "Hey, you're in really good shape. You must be a Navy SEAL." I'm not bullshitting.
That's hilarious.
I'm not bullshitting. And so what I'm getting at is like kids of America out there and even adults, America out there, they're listening to this show. They come to this show because they know they're going to hear a pretty fun conversation and they're going to get some advice from people who've done some stuff. They're going to get some mentorship specifically and they know who's on the episode, who's being featured. They know I got a Navy SEAL here right now. So any advice, John, you could offer, buddy?
Man.
Who wants to be a SEAL someday?
Sure. Well, when you mentioned being in shape, you know, being in shape in that elevator and the guys asked you if you're a frogman, absolutely, that's the easy part. Get your ass in shape. But the other part, and this is the much harder part, is to develop yourself. I am?
No, I'm sorry. Dropped on my end. Okay. I apologize.
Good.
I think I just interrupted your flow.
No, you're so good.
I was just asking for you to reflect on really advice for and I think I got that question out and I think you started.
Yeah, you did.
And my end, it dropped. So, and here I am screwing you up. Get back in your zone, man. Good. Sorry.
Yeah. So what I was saying, to get your ass in shape. I mean, you mentioned the guys in the elevator commenting on your physical shape, and mistaking you for a frogman. Well, if you're going to be a frogman, you got to get in shape. That's the easy part though. The hard part comes in preparing mentally. And honestly, some of the toughest guys and the best in shape guys that I saw show up at Buds, they quit in the first week, or during Hell Week. And like, for those of you who don't know, Hell Week is like either the fourth or fifth week. It changes depending on the time of year. It depends on the class, whatever. That's like the fourth or fifth week of BUDS, basic underwater demolition SEAL training. And it's a week long where you only sleep for 3 hours, the whole week, not 3 hours every night, but the whole week. And it's brutal. I mean, that's where we lose most of our guys. But it's not because they're in weak physical shape. It's because they're weak. Well, I don't want to say that every quitter is weak mentally. Every quitter is not prepared mentally for SEAL training, because there are some very strong mental guys who do quit just because they realize that this isn't what they wanted to do and they wanted to do something else. So I don't want to make it sound like I'm telling you that every quitter is weak. But as far as telling somebody to prepare for SEAL training, you got to get tough mentally and put yourself in tough situations intentionally. Like I was telling you about my coach in high school, putting me in that cold water and then making me run up the hill, you know, chasing everybody else, because everything is a competition. Well, everything at BUDS is a competition. You're divided into boat crews and you have to win all these races, and it pays to be a winner. So if you win a race, then you get a little bit of a chance to take a break. But anyway, what I was telling you is you got to get tough mentally, put yourself in some tough situations. Read the books about the training. I mean, hell, Court, you know, there's tons of SEAL books out there, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't swing a dead cat in a bookstore without seeing a freaking Friday on the cover of a book. Mm-hmm. There's tons of books about the training. Read all those books. Watch all the Discovery Channel documentaries and the YouTube videos that are out there. I mean, as cliche as that sounds, that'll help you, because you'll understand what's going to be coming your way. And then quite honestly, prepare yourself for the suck, because nobody escapes that, man. No matter how tough you are mentally, no matter how tough you are physically, The instructors there at Buds are ruthless, and they will find your weakness and they will look to exploit it. So be prepared for that. I'll put a plug in here for meditation and mindfulness. You got to develop your resilience, you know, make yourself tough mentally. And it has been shown scientifically that mindfulness and meditation can actually help to develop your resilience. So that when you are under high levels of stress, which you would be at Buds, the instructors have a way of putting you in those high levels of stress, you're going to handle them better, and then you're less likely to quit. So I guess that's my quick meditation and mindfulness plug there. But yeah, that's my quick advice, brother.
Yeah, well, I'm not letting you get off on one plug for meditation and mindfulness. Easy. So we're going to come back to it. But yeah, just really appreciate the thoughts here, you know. Navy SEAL John telling you, if you want to be a Navy SEAL, get your butt physically ready and get mentally tough. And as I listen to this, I'm like, okay, there's a lot of stuff out there how to prepare physically. I think it's the easy part. But I'm still trying to wrap my head around, how do I train my mental toughness? And I've been trying to search for this for a while, so much so that I'm looking at a sports psychology master's program with JFK University. I met with a PhD that has a sports psychology kind of formal training and theoretical approach, because all my stuff's experience-based, but I'm thirsty for the theory. And she actually serves United States Operations Command, United States Special Operations Command. That's what happens when you get out too long. You forget the damn acronym. USASOC, y'all. She's serving USASOC and really all the Green Berets within that portfolio. But I'm thinking, I'm mentally tough. Like, I know I am. But I don't know that I trained myself to get ready there. And I wasn't introduced to meditation until probably 35 years of age. But what I did have at a young age was I had prayer. And I have a really strong spirituality. And I don't know if prayer and meditation, well, actually I do know, because I know what meditation is. But I think there's a lot in common between those two things. So anyway, I'm kind of just running my mouth here. Just really hungry for, if you have anything to comment on, if not, we'll move on to the next question. But how do you get mentally tough?
I would love to comment on that.
How do you get mentally tough? Right?
Well, I would like to comment on that. And I also like to comment on the piece where you mentioned, prayer and meditation. I think I definitely feel that there's some overlap there in prayer and meditation, being quiet with yourself. And if you believe in a higher being, which I believe in a higher being myself, and I would say that I do both, but my meditation is quiet introspection, kind of looking internally, focusing on the physical experiences that I am feeling at the time. Whereas my prayer is kind of, obviously sending signals out into the universe. In my opinion, it's sending signals to my Heavenly Father. There's definitely overlap there. And some people say that prayer is where you talk to your God, and that meditation is where you listen to your God. I've heard that said about getting into scripture as well. You know, prayer is when you talk to God, and when you sit down and read scripture, that's when he's talking to you, he or she, depending on what you believe. That's my two cents on that. As far as just developing yourself mentally, you've got to put yourself in tough situations. You can't steer clear of things you fear. And I didn't mean that to rhyme, but it did. you can't like public speaking, in all honesty, Court, I freaking hate it. I hate it with a passion, but I attack it because I know it makes me feel uncomfortable. And in doing it, I get better at it, and I end up liking it more. Every time I do it, I like it more. Yeah. For those who are listening, as you're growing up and potentially thinking about joining special operations, whether it's special forces, whether it's SEALs, whether it's PJs, whatever the case may be, or doing anything that's hard, anything that's going to require mental toughness, it's something where you have to overcome your fear. And being brave doesn't mean having no fear. Being brave means overcoming that fear, having that fear and overcoming it. Yeah. And I think that's where mental toughness is really formed, is like in, you know, junior high and high school, in joining clubs that are going to force you to do public speaking, or join groups that are going to require a lot of hard work from you, because people fear hard work. But yeah, jumping in and joining a group where you're doing extracurricular activities after school and really having to manage your time, I mean, that's tough, but that I think helps to develop that mental toughness. And then, in all honesty, like we've already covered, sports, man. Sports is huge in developing mental toughness. You have to push yourself in, you know, you got to push yourself to the limit and then pass that limit. Your body is so much more capable than you think it is. And you only really find those new limits by playing sports. I don't think I know a single special operator, again, be it SEALs, Special Forces, PJs, that didn't play some sport in high school. I don't know anybody that just did academics or was just on the chess team. I mean, if there was somebody that was on the chess team, they also played sports. I'm not knocking anybody on the chess team. I'm just saying that you have to play sports really to help to develop that mental toughness. So that goes all the way back to your first question. So
yeah,
we already basically answered that.
I love it. Appreciate it. I think what I'm hearing from you, aside another call out to just stay active competitively in sport because it builds toughness, is this other thing of get comfortable being uncomfortable. And I think it's hard.
Oh, totally.
Especially if we're speaking in this moment to the younger person, the person who's 18 and younger, because I think there's a really deep feel of failure because of the social acceptance and all that stuff out there exists. But that's what we're doing. And you know, coming from two guys in their 40s, failure is not a bad thing. I've got a lot of it.
No.
What we use
for
and how it develops us, in this case, mentally. So thanks, John. Really appreciate it, man. I'd like to kind of marinate a little bit here on meditation and mindfulness. Sure. And I know you're a practitioner because you already talked about it. I consider you to be an expert. You're certified in this particular space. For me, I've actually taught meditation, not being certified, right? But just someone that thinks it's really impactful, read some books, and I taught it as an internal coach to a software company because I do think that regular practice is something that enables optimal performance.
Absolutely.
And I meditate regularly. Regularly being defined for me in my life is my goal is 5 times a week, which basically means Monday to Friday for me, because that's when I have my best structure. So 5 times a week for 3 to 5 minutes. And that might be mind-blowing for some people, because I think a lot of people that I coached meditation, they were like, it had to be a 30-minute out-of-body experience. 3 to 5 right. minutes for me is my typical meditative habit. And I do it on top of something else that I'm really regular with, which for me is my morning prayer and scripture study. So John, in this moment, I'm curious, as a certified mindfulness teacher, can we just start with maybe a definition for meditation? And then how does it relate? How does it differentiate maybe from mindfulness? Are they synonyms?
Oh, man, that's a great question.
Comment on this a little bit, man, please.
Yeah, totally. And this is actually, I do something similar to what you do, Court, as far as coaching corporate teams. With McCaskill Consulting, is I bring just an introduction to mindfulness and meditation to corporate teams. I certainly haven't done it to the level that you have, but I've coached a couple of teams around here locally in the Norfolk, Virginia area.
Oh, I don't know, man. I got to stop you. I think you probably did it at levels much more greater than I. And just to comment on that, mine was very intimate. It was a one-on-one experience. Yeah. And I was teaching one
That's
person.
Awesome.
Hey, don't be listening to this as a listener and think, hey, this is John, humility, John. John's out there crushing it with his work. Go ahead, continue.
Thanks, man. I appreciate that, brother. Well, what I was saying is in the presentations that I give to teams around here, this is a very common misconception, and this is part of my presentation, is that mindfulness and meditation are not synonymous. And if you can picture a Venn diagram with two circles, you've got meditation in one circle and you've got mindfulness in another circle, and there is overlap between them, and I'll discuss that here in a second. Meditation, there's a lot of different types of meditation. You've got mindfulness meditation, you've got transcendental meditation, you've got yoga nidra meditation. You've got all these different types, right? And what's common amongst them is that meditation is where you set aside, very deliberately set aside, a point of time or a period of time rather to meditate. So, you know, it's not where you're meditating while you're driving or meditating while you're talking with somebody else. It's you're very deliberate in setting aside some time. Now, you can do that while you walk. There's walking meditation, there's standing meditation, there's sitting, lying meditation, all that, but it's the time that you set aside to do it. So like you do with your 3 to 5 minutes in the morning, that 4 to 5 times a week, that is in fact meditation. Mindfulness, that other circle, is where you're paying attention to the present moment, the here and the now, and being very aware of all the bodily sensations that you're experiencing. So you notice your breath, you notice what you're seeing, you notice what you're hearing, smelling, touching, feeling, all that. And that's both physical and emotional feelings, right? Mm-hmm. And you're just very aware of that. And then you're aware of it without judging it. So, you know, if you're experiencing a sensation, whether it's physically or emotionally, you don't beat yourself up for, like, if you're feeling sad, you're like, okay, well, I'm feeling sad. You don't have to be like, well, I'm a bad person or I'm weak for feeling sad. You just notice that is the sensation, that's the experience that you're going through right now. So that's mindfulness. And then the two overlap with mindfulness meditation, and that's where you set aside, again, very deliberately set aside some time to be mindful. So my example is what I do in the mornings, and I try to do two mindfulness meditations a day. So one in the morning, one in the afternoon, 15 minutes in the morning, 15 minutes in the afternoon. I set aside that 15 minutes, sit down, start focusing on my breath, noticing the actual physical sensation of the breath coming into my nose. I notice my lungs inflating, my chest expanding, my diaphragm expanding, and then flip that. You know, as I breathe out, I notice the breath going out of my mouth. Notice that actual physical sensation of it, like, passing through my lips. I notice my lungs contracting, my chest contracting, and my diaphragm contracting. And then I go from there, from the breath, into, you know, what am I seeing? Even though I meditate with my eyes closed, I think about, what am I seeing with my eyelids closed? Because you still see colors, shapes, things like that. What am I hearing? What am I feeling? But that's, again, very intentional. So that's my mindfulness meditation. So, yeah, for your listeners, they are similar, but they're not synonyms. They're not exactly the same, but there is overlap between mindfulness and meditation. That mindfulness meditation, and that's what I'm a teacher of. I teach mindfulness meditation specifically because I fully believe in it. And I can get into this here in a bit, Court, but that's what I got introduced to, and that's what really made a change in my life, in how I was dealing with stress, anxiety, some ups and downs that I was having. And then I realized the impact that these two practices had on my life. And now I want to share it with others so that they can kind of get those same positive benefits.
Absolutely, man. Thank you so much for the sharing. Couple things that resonated deeply with me is just this idea that there's something that made a difference in your life at a time when life wasn't going great. And because of that, you wanted to make a focus on how you bring that to others. So thank you for that. Really, really interesting. For someone who's drinking the Kool-Aid, and I realize that not everybody does. I'll tell you, in a software company, teaching meditation is tough because those software engineers, they got engineer brains. And they're like, someone show me the science until I see science. And so maybe they were more interested in like a heart math approach. And we had to talk about coherence between you know, the impact of your heart rate and your breathing on your brain's function. And that's something that, in my opinion, an engineer-like person can get behind. But what I'm interested in here, John, please, is for someone that's drinking the Kool-Aid and wants to get started, man, how do you recommend that? Because I do a lot of guided meditation, and I use the app, and I put the headphones in. And I can meditate, you know, unguided too, but I couldn't start there. That's my experience. Yeah. So how do you recommend someone starts, buddy?
Yeah, I mean, I fully believe in the guided meditation apps. As a matter of fact, I've recorded some meditations on some of the meditation apps that are out there. And I believe that's a great way to start. Start very simple, start very short. You know, if 2 minutes is all you can do without your mind starting to wander, then do that 2 minutes. If you can do 30 seconds, do your 30 seconds, but build up. And that's what I tell people all the time. It's much like going to the gym. You know, you're not going to get under 300 pounds on the bench press day one. You're going to work your way up to that. And you start with, you know, 135 pounds and you work your way up, blah, blah, blah. Well, it's just the same with meditation. You start with 2 minutes, work your way up to 3 minutes, work your way up. Eventually you can do even if, like you mentioned, you're doing 3 to 5 minutes. If that's what you're comfortable doing all the time, do that. Because in all honesty, that's better than nothing, right?
Yeah.
It's a lot better than nothing. And then between guided and non-guided, I still, to this day, have times when I use guided meditation, because non-guided meditation, when you have to sit there and do it yourself, it is, it can be difficult.
Yeah.
And your mind can wander off more quickly than if you don't have that guided meditation. So there's times when I don't feel like I'm prepared to do the work that a non-guided meditation actually entails. So I'll listen to a guided meditation app. You know, I use Insight Timer. I've used Headspace. I've used eMindful, Calm. There's a lot of great ones out there. I like eMindful because, there's actually guided meditations on there, but then there's also live people that guide you through a meditation. You can, and after the meditation, you can correspond with them, which is super nice. But yeah, going back to what you mentioned, you know, teaching engineers and the science there, that's what got me to be a believer as well, because I'm very analytical. I've got my undergrad in mathematics and my master's degree in operations research. And until somebody explained the science behind meditation and mindfulness to me, I was not drinking the Kool-Aid. I was a skeptic.
Sure.
And so the science behind it, if I could just quickly get into that, the very act of sitting down to meditate and noticing that your mind is wandering, once you notice that your mind is wandering, you come back to whatever you're focusing on. So whether, you know, if you're doing transcendental meditation, you're focusing on a mantra, or if you're doing mindfulness meditation, you're focusing on your breath or the smells or something, you come back to that anchor. That very action, noticing that your mind is wandering and coming back to that, and doing it over and over and over through a meditation, that is actually developing a new neural pathway in your brain that allows you to focus more. And it rewires your brain as well to where the prefrontal cortex, that's the part of your brain that is responsible for cognitive thinking, that is what's going to respond to stimulus more so than the amygdala, which is the very small, like almond-sized part of your brain that's kind of responsible for fight, flight, or freeze. And that's what we react to most stimulus with, is our amygdala, because society has advanced faster than our brains have. So the amygdala was responsible for our reaction to threats. So like when we were cavemen and there was a saber-toothed tiger that we needed to react to, our amygdala reacted to that. Well, we don't have freaking saber-toothed tigers around every corner these days, but we react the same way. If somebody comes up to us at the desk and they, you know, put an assignment on the desk, we see that. And before we even know what it is, we react with a stress response. That amygdala is reacting rather than our prefrontal cortex, which could be responding. Well, through meditation, over and over, you're doing it. You're developing a new neural pathway, thickening the lining of the prefrontal cortex. You're going to react less with the amygdala and respond more with that prefrontal cortex with cognitive thinking. So your stress level is going to go down overall. Your cortisol response is going to go down overall. Ultimately, you're going to sleep better. As you sleep better, you sleep longer, you sleep deeper, then your body is, you know, going to heal better. It's going to feel better as well. And then when you are given those same responses, or rather the same tasks or something similar down the road, you're going to continue to respond rather than react. So it's kind of like this cycle where as you meditate more and more, you get healthier, and as you get healthier, your stress level goes down. As your stress level goes down, you sleep better. As you sleep better, you get healthier, and it just continually builds on itself. So for the skeptics out there who may be listening, it sounds kind of woo-woo when you first hear about practicing mindfulness, practicing meditation, but I swear by it. I went in to a psych. He told me, hey, you need to start practicing you need to start practicing meditation and mindfulness. I kind of laughed at him. I was like, no, man, I'm a 6'2", 215-pound Navy SEAL. I'm not going to go tell my guys that I'm meditating, because in my mind, a meditator was kind of a long-haired hippie or a monk, and I don't fit that profile. So he sat me down. He explained the science that I just ran through with you guys. And then I went back for 2 weeks, started practicing, came back, and I was like, no, doc, it's not working for me. And he kind of used that gym analogy that I used earlier. That's like going to the gym for 2 weeks and thinking that you're going to be in this great shape. Well, it doesn't work that way. You got to work at it. So I did it for like 2 months using the apps that I mentioned earlier. I think at the time I was using Insight Timer, and I still use that one fairly regularly as well. But Insight Timer, just doing, 10 to 15 minutes, work my way up to 10 to 15 minutes. And after about 2 months, I started seeing differences in who I was, how I was thinking through things, how I was responding to stress stimuli, how I was communicating with my coworkers, how I was communicating with my wife. I just saw all these changes. And then the real game changer was when people started coming to me and they're like, hey man, what are you doing differently? Because you seem happier, you seem healthier, you look better. Like I didn't have the black rings under my eyes. And they're like, hey, something is different. And at first I was a little hesitant to tell them, hey, I'm meditating. But then I told them, and the response that I thought I was going to get, oh, great. And like this glaze over look. But people asked me more and more about it. They're like, well, tell me more. And then going back, I'll stop rambling. Last thing is, when I've taught fellow SEALs, so I've taught some folks in the Honor Foundation. And when I first stood up in front of them, I could see this kind of look like, great, we're going to hear about meditation. And I taught them this class. And then at the end, I run them through a guided meditation. And I keep my eyes open when I run the guided meditation. I don't meditate as I'm teaching. I focus on the people that I'm teaching. And I can see the stress like melt out of their bodies as I'm teaching them. And at the end of the class, all these people that were kind of looking at me all like skeptical or like, great, this is going to be a complete waste of my time. They come up to me afterwards like, hey man, that 15 minute meditation was better rest than I've gotten in the past 8 weeks sleeping. Yeah. So there's definitely reticence amongst people to practice this because of the way Western culture has kind of made it seem. It seems like it's something for the weak or the weird, when in fact, I think it's the exact opposite. I think it's for the people who are very strong-minded that do this. Some of the top-performing individuals in America, in the world, in corporate America, in the corporate world, are practicing meditation. And it transfers directly, like you were mentioning at the beginning of the show, to high performance. I fully believe in that, man. And I've seen it in myself. I've seen it in others. And not only does it transfer or translate directly to high performance, but it translates to a lower stress level and a happier and healthier life. So that's my drum, man. I'll stop beating it for now. But yeah, you can tell I'm passionate about this stuff, right? Sorry, man. I talked for a while.
Absolutely. It's exactly what we're looking for here. And if anyone out there is listening and they're still unconvinced, I'm going to encourage you to reach out and have a one-on-one conversation with John for him to make the case, because he can make a good case. I'm just going to introduce a book in this moment that I actually was exposed to in my leadership coaching program. It's called Start Here, Mastering the Lifelong Habit of Well-Being.
Nice.
And in that book, they introduced 9 practices to well-being, and meditation is the first one they cover. It's written by a PhD, and there's a lot of science in there that I think people can appreciate. But some folks don't have the patience to read anymore these days, and unfortunately, there's no damn audio book for that thing, so you actually got to do the work. Hell, just read that chapter. And then the third thing I want to offer is, and this is, you know, really without John's knowledge, but John hosts his own podcast, y'all, called Veterans Path. And it is particularly focused on real people's stories where meditation and mindfulness have helped them perform at a higher level in their life. So, hey, man, if you don't want to read, go to Veterans Path. Listen to the people that John have on his show and let them make the case for you. And here's some real intimate shit when you go to that podcast. You're going to hear about a guy that was abused physically. You're going to hear about folks that struggle with alcohol and that meditation actually was a path that helped them out of those things. So at any rate, thanks, John. Let's continue here, boss. And I'm going to ask, because I think it's a good moment, if you'd be open to a little bit more vulnerability here,
sure.
And just talk a little bit about something that you're pretty open and transparent with, which is kind of your struggle with stress and your struggle with depression. And I'm just curious, was there an impact, if any, to stress and depression in your workplace performance?
Oh, yeah, dude, it was huge. I mean, I had no desire to be at work. No desire to be anywhere, really. But yeah, my depression had a major impact on my workplace performance. I didn't communicate with my colleagues. I didn't communicate with my supervisors. We're not well anyway. My output was super low, and the quality of my output was literally the bare minimum. What can I do to not get in trouble? What's the least I can do and still, you know, kind of fly under the radar? And it impacted every facet of my workplace performance. So yeah, depression's a huge thing, and you know, with me, that's what I've seen. With others, I've seen other people in the military who are depressed and how that affects them, their workplace performance. I've seen how it keeps them from even showing up. Their absenteeism, you know, starts to skyrocket as their depression increases, and that's a downward spiral real fast. You know, as people stay away from work, then they're more lonely, and they don't get that interaction. Then they get further depressed, and then they stay away from work. It's just a seriously dangerous slippery slope to get on. This is one of the reasons I'm very passionate about introducing these, what I call life-changing, but also life-saving practices, because I fully believe that not only will they change your life, but if you're in a very deep depression, they can potentially save your life. And I've spoken, like you were mentioning before, on Veterans Path, I've spoken with guests who have been right there on the edge, you know, considering taking their life, and you know, at the last second someone introduced them to mindfulness and meditation, and it literally saved their lives. And now they're not only saved, not spiritually, but like physically saved, and they are performing at a new level. So it is life changing, life saving. I fully believe that.
And just another question here for clarity. When we talk about stress, I think people can settle into that. Like we all feel stressed. When we use the word depression, though, I've grown just because I now know folks that are clinically depressed, as opposed to, I feel depressed today. Could you maybe qualify the word depression in your experience? Which of the two was it? Just, hey, man, I feel like crap. Or was it more of a clinical range?
Oh, no, it was clinical. I mean, and that's why, in all honesty, that's why I was seeing the psychologist and the psychiatrist that I was, because it was ongoing. And it stemmed from a couple of things. It stemmed from, there was some type of chemical imbalance going on, but it also stemmed from survivor guilt that I was struggling with.
Sure.
From time in the teams, losing brothers when I felt that I should have been gone and whatever. But it was definitely the difference that I mean, I've never had somebody define this for me, but the difference that I saw was, it wasn't that I was just feeling crappy or that I was feeling sad in a day. It was over a protracted amount of time.
Sure.
And it was in almost everything that I was doing. Like, I wasn't getting any fun out of spending time with my family. I wasn't having any fun, doing the things that I used to enjoy. I wasn't trying to get out of bed in the morning to go hit the gym or attack the day that I used to get up and attack the day. And the Navy ended up, saying, okay, well, yeah, you've got some things going on. We're going to put you on different medications. And I think there's a time and a place for those medications. And they definitely had, some of them had positive effects on me, but I felt that the negative effects outweighed the positive effects for me personally.
Sure.
So what I was feeling, I started to feel less anxiety about things. But I felt numb to things, even on those medications. I wasn't feeling sad, but I wasn't feeling happy either. I was just kind of numb and just kind of going through the motions. Okay. Yeah. Life is happening. It's not bad, but it's not good either. If that makes sense. And so I didn't like feeling like that. And I took myself completely off the medications, which, bad idea. If you're listening, don't take yourself off stuff like I did. Like I went cold turkey. I'm like, hey, I'm just going to stop. And I talked to a psych, and the psych was like, that's not how you're supposed to do it. If you're going to come off of it, you're supposed to wean yourself off of it. But since you did, I'm going to introduce you to some other things. And I wish I could find this guy. He introduced me to mindfulness and meditation, and I truly feel that he kind of helped me to get back the John McCaskill that was before. And that's where I am today. So I feel a lot happier, healthier, in where I am, in how I deal with ups and downs in my life. Stress hasn't gone away. Meditation and mindfulness doesn't make stress go away, but it's how you handle it that changes. That's my quick two cents on depression. I fully believe that it is a clinical thing. It's not just, hey, you're feeling bad for the day. Something is off, and it can be addressed through therapy. It can be addressed through medicine if need be, but it can also be addressed through mindfulness and meditation. And in all honesty, sometimes all three of those things need to come together to help, but it's another tool in the proverbial tool bag to help out with dealing with depression. Absolutely. I believe in it. I've experienced it. I've experienced coming out of that depression because of it. So I'm a forever believer, man.
Appreciate you and your willingness to kind of open that up. Cause I think In that sharing, it goes a bit deeper for a listener as they begin to settle in to kind of who you are, what you're about, and how this mindfulness and meditation has had an impact. And I just think in this moment, I just want to share this thought that's coming to me right now, you know, because this is my experience. Rape isn't real until it hits your family or a friend, right? Physical abuse of a child isn't real until it hits your family. Depression may not be real until it hits someone from your family, right? But I'm telling you, man, this stuff may hit at some point if it hasn't already. And my call out here is to be open to acceptance that this stuff is part of others' lives, maybe much earlier than your own, because my life was incredible growing up. My childhood, everything. And I thought that this stuff wasn't real. Oh, you're depressed. You just got a problem. Come on, pull yourself out of it. But I want to highlight what John talked about. And John said a chemical imbalance. That's real science shit. I'm not a scientist, right? But so what I'm saying is if you're listening and you may be suffering with what you think is a depressed state or depression, or you know someone that you care about that may be, go ahead and seek out some real advice, because it might be something chemical that you can't fix. And I'm getting way out of my ability to talk smartly about things here, and I'm too super clear of that. So I'm going to shut it down right here, because I am not a doctor, and I don't have an ability to really do this really well. I'm just sharing about my life experience, and in some cases, things that I thought weren't really real until they began to hit my own life. So sharing that out. John, I think you did a really good job of just talking through kind of your kind of depressed, stress-laden state and pulling out of there. But if I can just, you know, kind of ping you here very pointedly, could you maybe identify a few things that helped you come out of that you think you may have not already covered? Or do you feel like you hit that well enough that there's nothing new that you'd be able to go through with a question like that?
No, I could expound upon that a little bit more. What a couple of things. One, I would recommend having or finding a support system. And you know, having friends and family you can rely on, that's huge. But also, I would recommend not dumping everything on them. They are a great support, but they're not your professional counselors, right? So I think at some point, people, no matter who they are, your support system, if you're dumping everything on your friends and family, at some point they're going to get fatigued about hearing your woes, your what it is you're going through, because again, they're not the professionals and they can only help so much. I mean, the support that they can offer you is huge, and that's I believe fully in, but they can't, you know, prescribe anything. They can't make professional recommendations. So I would say seek out that counseling. Still go to see the mental health professionals. And that's not weakness, like you mentioned before. I had that same perception initially when I entered the teams and I heard about people struggling with stress, anxiety, or depression. I was like, man, that's weak. That's weak genes, weak minds. And yeah. It is not at all. Seeking mental health support, that's like mental health maintenance. And it's just, again, I'm sorry to keep using this analogy, but it is just like going to the gym. We don't go to the gym only when we are weak. We go to the gym even when we are strong. We go to the gym to maintain physical health. Well, it's just like that. Going to the counselor can help when you're struggling, and that can help, you know, maintain your mental health. And then of course, yeah, I mean, I'll keep beating this drum as long as you let me, man. I do highly recommend meditation and mindfulness, because that in and of itself can help you identify things to talk to those counselors about. You know, you may not even know what to talk about when you go and sit down with those folks, but doing some quiet introspection, some things are going to bubble up in that quiet time that you may not be aware of because you've been going nonstop. You haven't given yourself time to even think about what may be bringing you down. And when you stop for 10, 15 minutes, you meditate and you start think, man, my mind is racing. My mind is wandering off to all these different spots. Maybe that's where it needs to go. Maybe it needs to go to thinking about X, Y, or Z, because that's what's stressing you out, but you hadn't even realized it until you took that time, that quiet time to think about it. And now you identify those things, and then you can go to a counselor and be like, hey, these are the things that are stressing me out. And so they kind of go hand in hand. The counseling and the mindfulness and the meditation can be hugely helpful when they are implemented together. They're complementary. They're not mutually exclusive. So yeah, that's, I guess I didn't really offer anything new there. I just further expounded upon the seeking out the counseling.
Yeah, no, certainly there are new things there. I mean, the call out for the support network and stuff like that. So, and yeah. It's important because these are things that were helpful for you and it's your perspective and how I think it can be informative to help others is what this show is all about. So thank you for entertaining and sharing that. I would like to kind of transition in the conversation a little bit. And to be honest, this is a selfish question, only because it's where my focus is in my work, which is transition, right? Transition support, men and women in transition. And I got to be honest, man, you're doing it really well, in my opinion, outside.
Thanks, brother.
I mean, so much so that as I just look for a moment about kind of where you're at. I mean, you're still in the Navy right now, right? Let's not forget about y'all listening. This guy is in the Navy right now and in the middle of the transition though, right? So how far out are you, John? When does retirement come? August, am I right?
Yeah, August. That's right. Yeah, you got it. August 1st.
Okay.
July 31st will be my last day in the Navy.
All right. So still a couple months out from retirement. And when we first met over a year ago, I got to be honest, man, I thought you were already out or danger close to getting out. And you're probably 2 years out at that moment. And so for anybody listening, especially the folks within my network who are those veterans in transition, here's a man that's been at it deliberately for quite some time. Also, I can tell you, and John won't tell you this, but John's incredibly active on LinkedIn. He's got, you know, in the tens of thousands of kind of followers within his network. And so it's really hard in some cases to embrace that social media. I'm not being an advocate for Facebook or Instagram or all that stuff while you're in service, because the digital dandruff is real, especially for my tight network, which is that special ops community. But I would encourage you to maybe consider what you can learn from getting on LinkedIn. John founded and is operating his own company right now. Bottom line, what I'm getting at, y'all, and what I'm getting out for you here, John, in this question is, in my opinion, you've took a very deliberate approach to your transition. And because of that, I think there's got to be some things that people can learn from your approach. So would you mind sharing maybe just a few thoughts for men and women in transition right now? And I know we're focused on military transition, but this applies, in my experience, to anybody that's in a transition state. Any thoughts you might share?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be happy to, man. And I quite honestly owe my transition experience to one guy who introduced me to other people, and then I owe a lot of the other experience to those people. One of whom is yourself, but I'll get into that here in a second. But the one guy that kind of started the fire underneath me for transition was a former 06, he had retired, Navy SEAL, Matt Stevens, who is now the CEO of the Honor Foundation, funny enough. But at the time, he was working for a UAV organization, and he was doing a lot of traveling, and I don't know that he was 100% happy with the amount of work and travel that he was doing, and he felt that his transition was not as well planned out as it could be. And he sat me down probably a little over 2 years ago now and was like, hey, if you're thinking about retiring after you're 23 years or whatever, then you need to start thinking about transition now. You need to start planning what it is you're going to be doing now, figuring out what industry you're going to be getting into. And so I did that. I worked for this guy twice in the Navy. I absolutely love the guy. And I really appreciate his guidance, and I consider him a mentor. So if he tells me something, I'm going to, oh, okay, got it, ready to execute. So I sat down, kind of laid out my plan of how I was going to become a commercial real estate guy. And then I sat down and I spoke with several commercial real estate guys and further developed that plan. And then I realized, you know what, this is all well and good if this is what you're passionate about. But where I had made a mistake is I hadn't identified kind of my purpose, and commercial real estate was not it. Great job, not knocking that at all. Some of the other industries that I considered were fantastic work, but it wasn't something that I was passionate about. So what I ended up doing was getting connected with organizations like the Commit Foundation, which, funny enough, you and I had connected before I got connected with the Commit Foundation. I got connected with the Commit Foundation, and then Court, or listeners, Court ended up being my coach. So Court and I know one another as friends, and then he has been my coach as well. So I very much appreciate Court's guidance in my transition. So thanks. That's a quick thank you and call out to you, brother. And the Commit Foundation was huge. American Corporate Partners, ACP, they partner you up with corporate leaders in America that are willing to be your mentors for a year. And I got connected with a great mentor for that. His son is actually a PJ, or was going into PJ at the time. So it was kind of a mentor-mentor relationship. I got to tell him about special operations as he was telling me about corporate America. Onward to Opportunity is another great thing that's out there for people. But I'm telling you all these organizations and foundations and opportunities, but I guess really what I want to tell your listeners who are in transition, whether it's from the military or if it's, you know, transitioning out of one organization to another, or transitioning from being an elite athlete to being a business person, start figuring out what your transition is going to look like. Start it out early, figuring out what your why is, your purpose, and then identify an industry that fits that. Once you identify that industry, come up with a plan of action and milestones. That's what we call it in the military, a POAM, plan of action and milestones. So basically set your goal of, you know, retirement date or separation date from the military. You want to get a job in industry X. What does it take to get that? So it's going to take some certifications. It's going to take some schooling. It's going to take some knowing people. So you're going to have to network within that industry or with people connected to that industry. And then once you kind of set that plan, execute. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the military term for getting something started. Once you've got something planned, go ahead and do it. So execute that plan. And then something I didn't mention is I highly recommend reading a lot. First about transition. There's a couple of books that I recommend in military transition, and quite frankly, this first one applies to military transition or transition in any form, is called Designing Your Life. And that one helps you to kind of figure out what you find happiness in and where you don't find happiness. And that's a book that the Commit Foundation recommends. And I fully believe that book is instrumental in my finding what it is that I wanted to do. Other ones are like Simon Sinek's Finding Your Why. That's a great one because you need to know what purpose you want to serve. And then a new one that's out, and it's actually written by one of your brothers, their Court, Herb Thompson, former Green Beret, also a fellow Tough Next Step guy. He wrote this new one called The Transition Mission, and I fully endorse that one. It's a great one, kind of outlines what you can do to prepare yourself for success through a military transition. So that's reading about transition itself. And then once you do identify the industry that you want to go into, I recommend reading as much as you can, watching as much as you can about those industries, so that when you get out, you know, whether it's 2 years from now or whether it's you get out, you know, 6 weeks from now, at least you have an idea of what that industry entails. Because I'll be honest, when I started dabbling in what commercial real estate was, I had kind of these dollar signs in my eyes, and that's what I was starting to think about chasing, were the dollar signs. Because I mean, there can be good money in commercial real estate, but there can also be some serious dry spells where you're not selling anything. So if you don't know that going in, it could be a rude awakening. And luckily I had a guy tell me that he went a year and a half living out of his car before he made his first sale. And I'm like, well, crap, man, I've got two kids, I've got a wife, I can't be living out of my car. So commercial real estate, that's not going to be what I do. Not that I'm going to be making millions as a mindfulness teacher either, but that's not my why anyway. You know, making a fortune is not my why. Serving others, that's what I've found to be my why. And I think that's critical in figuring out what your transition is like, is figuring out what your why is, your personal why, or as the Commit Foundation, Pursue Your Purpose. And that's kind of what you and I went through together, that Pursue Your Purpose program, I think is phenomenal in identifying what your purpose is. Once you can identify that, then you can kind of, the other parts fall into place. So I guess the big piece there, Court, is start early, man. Start as early as you can.
Yeah. And I think, and I really love all the incredible, like real practical things you offered up here, some great books, some tools. I just want to comment on the early thing. Sometimes people don't have that luxury. You think of the athlete that blows the ACL, it's not going back to play. It may have come at a time when, hey man, there's an injury here that's stopping me from doing something that I love, and I can't start early because I wasn't even thinking about it. I was just thinking about keeping playing. Or there's a guy that gets blown up in the military and he's got some significant trauma and he's not able to be the SEAL anymore, or the Green Beret, or whatever, you name it, because it's not just SEALs and Green Berets that are getting hurt doing this incredible work for our nation. And it comes early. Well, don't be discouraged by John's comment, because you execute the same thing. You still got to have a plan. You still got to use these resources. You just might have a compressed timeline. It's even more so applicable to have a plan. I can't tell you how many people that I engage with in my work that when I ask them the question, you know, what does your best life look like? Or what does fulfillment look like for you next in this career? Where they're like, well, I don't know. I'm like, well, shit, I can't help you then, right? Because I ain't got the answer. So, you know, John offered up ways to find the answer with the reading, with the networking, with the other things that he mentioned based upon his plan. I want to continue here, man, and really just focus on your company, McCaskill Consulting. And specifically, we'd just love for you in this moment to share out, what's that vision and mission for that company, and how you're serving others? You mentioned it a little bit. My guess is you're doing that mindfulness and meditation stuff. But do you mind sharing, John, just specifically about that work?
Yeah, I mean, in all honesty, I started McCaskill Consulting without having a clear idea of what it is I wanted to do under that McCaskill Consulting umbrella. So I knew that I wanted to do something where I made others better, or I made organizations better. And that to me was quote unquote consulting. So I was like, okay, well, I'm just going to start McCaskill Consulting and then figure out what it looks like later. So I guess, you know, in some people say build the fort, you know, build the fort and then fix it up later, make it look pretty later. Well, that's what I did with McCaskill Consulting. Hey, I'm just going to start it and then figure out what it looks like later. And then what that did end up looking like was, as I was starting to go through transition, and I was touching on this earlier, when people were starting to come up to me and asking me what I was doing differently, what I was doing that was making me feel better, what I was doing that was making me more focused, kind of that light bulb popped up above my head, and I realized that mindfulness is what I can teach people. I can actually do this for a living, and I can help to get people to be happier and healthier at work. And if they're happier and healthier at work, then that can help them to be happier and healthier in life. And, you know, I probably am not going to be able to sell that piece, because I guess that's my mission, is to get people to be happier and healthier at work so that they can be happier and healthier in life. But if I go to a corporate, you know, C-suite, I'm like, hey, I'm going to help to get your workforce happier and healthier. Most people aren't going to buy off on that. So the way that I kind of couch it for the C-suite, when I talk to them, I'm like, well, look, I am going to help you increase your bottom line by having a happier and healthier workforce. So people are more focused, they're more productive, they communicate better, they're more creative at work if they are able to tap into those parts of their brain, which meditation helps to do. So that's how I kind of sell it to the C-suite. But again, what I'm more concerned about is having a happier and healthier workforce, because I feel that people these days are overstressed, overstimulated, and then at work, and then when they get home, they continue to be connected to work through their iPhones or whatever smart device they've got, checking emails, checking social media. We are constantly bombarded and overstressed, and we are more connected than ever with work and more disconnected than ever with our family. And if we can be connected with work while we are at work, crush as much work as we can during the number of hours that we have to work, and then disconnect and know that there's a distinct line between the two, go home, spend time with family, you're actually going to, ironically, because you took that time with family, because you took that time to yourself, maybe you live by yourself, but you're taking time to yourself when you go home, you're ironically going to be more productive the next day, and then more productive the next day, because it's just like you're a battery, right? You can't run a battery all the time. You need that battery to recharge. Well, going home, recharge, you're able to come back to work more charged up and do more. So anyway, I guess I got certified to teach mindfulness through Sean Fargo. He's one of Google's mindfulness experts. He created an organization called the Mindfulness Exercise Institute. I got certified through him, and then I started teaching corporate teams. I thought it was just going to be like one or two gigs here before I got out of the military, and it ended up being a fairly lucrative gig. I mean, not making tons, but as far as an additional gig on the side, I'm doing okay. But really what I am thrilled about, not so much the extra money. I mean, yeah, that's nice. Don't get me wrong. It's nice having some extra money, but, I like the fact that I'm able to better people, make people better, and happier and healthier. So, that's a little bit about my company and how it got started and what the mission and vision is, brother.
Well said, man. And if I could just sum up what I'm hearing from you, is that you're in the business of performance enhancement. Don't know that you use the words, but I think that's what I'm hearing. So for anybody out there running a business, managing a team, looking for something to bring in that you may have thought about before, but you can't figure out how to do it or who can do it for you, reach out to John, and you're going to have a seasoned, high quality, high performing Navy SEAL that's walked the walk, that can come and relate with your audience and teach a practice that enhances your performance. So, John, thanks for sharing, man. I'm stoked for
man.
You.
Thank you.
What you're doing is important, and I hope you continue it. Just got a few more questions here for you, man. I think three in total. You know, of course, this is High Performance Pathways, and I think what we talked about here mostly to date is just this incredible perspective that you've drawn upon of how to perform at a high level in a number of different ways. And if I'm wrong, let me know. But I feel like that's what the hell we've been talking about, right? But
yeah, absolutely.
I want to be a bit more tactical here in my question, because I think people do know that when they come to this show, they're going to hear someone's incredible experience, but then they're also going to maybe get a couple takeaways that I think serve to maybe confirm some of the habits that they have in their own life that are helping them perform, or maybe they learn a couple new ones. And so my first question here is, you know, as you reflect on your time in the military, and we're talking high performance now specifically, and your ability to perform at a high level beyond meditation, is there any other habits that you feel strongly you're going to walk away from the Navy with, and that will continue as practices for you that you're convinced will help you continue to perform at a high level?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, man. I'd say number one, and this has been kind of the theme through the show, is take care of yourself. And that may sound selfish, but you can't perform at your best and you can't take care of others if you're not taking care of yourself. So that includes, you know, staying fit, eating right, trying to get good sleep, and then, of course, taking care of yourself mentally. But we've already kind of beat that dead horse. So, yeah, taking care of yourself physically, eating right, getting good sleep mentally. And I think that also includes giving yourself a chance to decompress and have fun. So, you know, have fun with your friends and your family, and then have fun on your own. If that means going for a run and just kind of unplugging from the world for a little while, or if it means going snowboarding or whatever the case may be, have some fun in your life, man. That's what a life is meant to. We're meant to have some fun. And then another one, and this one is a big one, is setting goals and not just like I want to be a millionaire or I want to be, you know, the best salesperson of the century, or I want to, qualify for the Boston Marathon. Those are great. Those are lofty goals, and there's nothing wrong with those goals. But I think you need to have goals like that you break down into micro goals and develop what I call, and I've seen this term before, but goal ladders. So, what were the examples that I used? So, Boston Marathon. So, for example, if your goal is to qualify for Boston, you know, you write that on the top of a sheet of paper, and then you break that down. I mean, you're not just going to go out one day and run Boston, right? There's other pieces that come into that. So, what are your micro goals or the rungs along that goal ladder that lead up to the top of that goal ladder? So, maybe running a 5K is one of the rungs at the beginning, and then a 10K, and then a half marathon, and then so on. And you even break those down further into micro goals. So, you know, you're not going to jump off the couch and run a 5K. If you've never run before, you're going to have to work your way up to that. So maybe your first goal is to run, you know, 4 laps around the track. And then once you accomplish that goal, you actually line it out. Like you have these goal ladders drawn out because it helps to have them visible. Well, you line out that goal once you attain it, because there's actually like physiologically stuff that happens. You're going to get the dopamine hit and to get the oxytocin that you get, you know, saying, okay, good. I got something done. I'm working my way towards that goal. And every time you line something out, you're going to build yourself up. So do that over and over until the micro goals, you know, you break those goals down over and over until those micro goals are realistic and attainable, and that ultimately makes your ultimate goal at the top of that list realistic and attainable. And then that all said, and I learned this, I'll tell you a little personal anecdote here in a second, but the last step is at the top of that ladder, you may have that Boston Marathon written as your goal, but above that, right, what's next? Because I think that always having, you know, what's next, on your list, that allows you to always be looking for the next goal. Because once you attain that goal, it's going to feel awesome. Once you attain that Boston Marathon, you qualify for Boston, you run it, it's going to feel amazing that you did it. But then you're going to come off that high real quick and you're going to say, well, shoot, now what? That's going to be your big question. Now what? And if you haven't identified the what's next, you could slip into a depressive state. And my anecdote was, I was touching earlier about, or I was talking earlier about my high school cross country team and how much of a brotherhood that was. And we ran together. We did everything together. I did it for 4 years, basically ran nonstop for 4 years. High school, senior year, 1996, or I guess it was, I graduated in 96, so this was the fall of 1995. We win the state championship, nationally ranked. We went undefeated that season, and I was super excited, but I hadn't thought about, okay, well, what's my next goal? And I went home as a senior in high school, and I mean, I'm going to be completely vulnerable here with you, Court, but I cried my eyes out because I'm like, well, shit, what do I do now? And I found that if in today, and since I've, you know, graduated high school and leading up to today, if I draw these goal ladders out and I don't put a what's next at the top, when I attain those goals, then I get, I kind of get upset. So it's always good to write what's next at the top of that goal ladder. So, let's see, what did I say there? So I would say the habits are take care of yourself, mentally and physically. And then in the practice of setting goals, you know, set those ultimate goals, break them down into micro goals or goal ladders. And then at the top of that goal list, above the very top of the ladder, write what's next and have that idea before you attain that, the top of that ladder. So yeah, those are some of my habits, brother.
Yeah, man, I freaking love it, dude. And this idea of ladders and next step at the top of it, never heard before. I think it's incredible. And I'm just reflecting right now on my own life. And my brother and I, my younger brother, have made a commitment to run a half marathon. And that's like this lofty goal for us. Like, let me put it in perspective. My brother's probably about 260, 6 foot, played college baseball. He's one of my brothers. He's a big boy. And yeah, him saying, I'm going to run 13 miles for him, I mean, it's incredible. He's never run 6 miles in his life, y'all.
Yeah.
And he ran 6 miles under an hour last week, y'all, because nice, we had a damn goal ladder. Not that we made it up. We didn't call it that. But there's the physical world is probably the easiest, right? Because someone's going to tell you, you got to do this and this to do this. So to run 13.1 in 10 weeks, here's what you got to do each week, right? But what I can tell you is when he sent me that, I printed it off. It's taped to my refrigerator. And every day I'm looking at it. And if I could just take a photo in this moment for y'all, I would. But you will see that after every mileage goal that's there, and today's actually an off day for me, but yesterday I had to run 4 miles, and the day before that it was five, and then four behind that. And I got to run 7 tomorrow. That's my goal ladder. I put check marks. I write a date on it. And guess what else I do? I snap a photo, and I send it to my brother to keep him inspired.
There you go.
So the oxytocin that you're talking about, the dopamine release from actually having that stuff written down is powerful, right? And then I generated a practice in my own life where I do annual personal goals, 3, and annual professional goals every January of every year. Didn't do that in the Army, but in these past few years, I've done that a lot, and they're really helpful. So thanks, John, for opening the door for me to comment in addition to kind of what inspired me from what you shared out there. One more question, man, and it's about teaming and the high-performing team. And I'm just curious, given all of your experience going back to cross-country through your time with the SEAL teams, when you look at, you know, a team, what does it take to be high-performing?
Oh, man. There's...
And let me help, right? Because you're like, holy crap, Court. Let me refine. Like, isolate maybe the top couple things, because you probably say, Court, there's tons, man. I think that's what you're about to say. So it was an unfair question.
That was actually exactly what I was just about to say. There are innumerable things that kind of come into play in developing a high-performing team. But I would say in the top 2 to 5, the things that are constant across all high-performing teams are communication, trust, and psychological safety. And I would say that if a team doesn't have those, it's going to fail. And if a team does have those three things, it is most likely going to succeed. So communication, communicate often, but I would make sure that it is effective and efficient communication. So, you know, don't hold meetings just to hold meetings. I hate that. Everybody hates that. It's a waste of time. If you have something that you need to figure out, if you have something that you need to communicate, then do it, but don't just hold the meeting because it's time for the meeting, right? So I would say if you have a meeting, have an agenda, have a goal to that communication, trust. And that's built over time. And it's, once it's compromised, it's virtually impossible to rebuild, but it can be built by, those that, by empowering those who work for you. So give them the hard jobs, but don't give them the hard jobs because you don't want to do that hard job. Give them the hard job because they want those jobs. And more often than not, they do. They want those hard jobs. That's why they're working. If they don't want those hard jobs, then probably there's something else that needs to be worked through. But, you know, give them those hard jobs, allow them to flourish, allow them to grow, allow them to learn. And in doing so, you're going to learn from them what they're capable of, and it's going to grow your level of trust in them. As they're doing those hard jobs, check on how they're doing with those jobs and, you know, work as a leader to remove any impediments that they have on getting those jobs done. So your job is not to get that job done. Your job is to make their getting that job done easier. So you're kind of working as a servant leader, and that's going to build the trust up and down. So they see you removing those impediments to their getting the job done. So they're going to start to trust you, and you're going to start to trust them because they're getting those hard jobs done. That's trust. And then finally, the psychological safety, I think as a leader, you must provide that. So people should feel comfortable coming to you about work-related challenges, and you cannot, as a leader, be closed off from your people, or you cannot be a tyrant. If you are constantly barking up and down at your people, eventually they're going to shut off. They're just going to they're not going to want to work for you anymore. That obviously goes back to the trust piece. If you're beating up on them at work constantly, then their level of trust in you is completely gone, and you're never going to get that back. So the psychological safety and the trust piece, I think, are very much tied together. So those are, the, in my opinion, the three of the most important things any high-performing team can have is communication, which is effective and efficient, trust, which is built up over time and is very hard to get back once it's compromised. And then psychological safety. As a leader, you have to be open to listening to your people and the challenges that they have at work, and you cannot be a tyrant. So those are some of the things I think I've seen in the high performing teams that I've been a part of, brother.
Appreciate it. I can kind of see myself here listening intently, and I'm drawing pictures in my mind of my experience where I have seen success and failure in the teams I've been a part of, and in some cases the teams that I've managed and led based upon those three competencies, those three habits. So appreciate it. Last question, yeah. Man. I just have this curiosity and what's next for you as you move forward this year, maybe post August and into retirement, hey man, what's next on that goal ladder, right? And I'm telling you, I know there was no gold ladder, that had this podcast on it, but I just thought it'd be interesting to kind of bring that into this question. But what's next, man, for you?
Oh, well, first off, funny enough, it didn't have this specific podcast on it, but it did have getting on podcasts and sharing my message, because I do feel so strongly about mindfulness and meditation that I feel that getting on people's podcasts and sharing it with people like yourself, hosts like yourself, and getting the word out there, that's important. So Yeah, your specific podcast wasn't on there, but Get On podcast was part of my goal ladder to where I am today, and then ultimately where I'm heading. So to answer your question, what's next in 2020 and beyond? August 1st, I retire. July 31st is my last day in the Navy. Back that up for house hunting and job hunting, and I'm doing air quotes like you can see it right now, because job hunting, that's just 10 days that I'm going to get, because I already have a job lined up. But so basically July 10th or 11th thereabouts, I'm going on terminal leave. And for those of you who are in the military, that's basically the time that I'm still getting paid by the military, but it's as I'm wrapping up my career. So I will be jumping in the RV with my wife, my two little kids. I've got a 3-year-old little girl and a 1-year-old little boy, and my dog, and we're going to head west to Colorado, kind of identify a home base there in Colorado Springs area. And then, the plan right now, if all goes well, is to travel around the country for somewhere between 6 and 12 months, seeing this great country that I've had the amazing opportunity to serve, but haven't had that many opportunities to really see it. So we're going to see all the sites that people tell me about all the time. I have this huge list of places to see and experiences to experience, but we're also going to play it by ear. You know, this is one place or one time I'm going to have a list of places to see and those experiences, but I'm not going to say, hey, we need to be here by this date at this time, because I can get obsessive and compulsive about that planning. But I will let the family go with the flow and see what that plays out to be. And then I'm going to continue working for the nonprofit Veterans Path, where we teach mindfulness and meditation to vets to help them find that peace, acceptance, transformation, and honor that you touched on at the beginning of the show. So that's what's next for me and my family, man.
I'm a bit jealous. Jealous of the RV trip, man. I think a lot of people talk about that. I don't know that anyone actually executed at the level that you have planned. So, hey, man, share me some social media posts as you move around this great world, and watch out. You know, maybe you'll find some place you don't know about, and Colorado Springs won't be home base. Maybe you'll say, you know, this place, San Francisco, is pretty cool. I don't know. Never been to San Francisco, but I think there are a number of great places in this country that I hope to visit myself at some point someday. So, hey, brother, that's a wrap, man. We'd really just love to invite you to break us down and out of here and back into our days. And we do that very deliberately here on the show with the High Performance Breakdown. And it goes like this, man. I'm going to say, hey, John, break down on three. I'm going to count 1, 2, 3. And when you hear three, that's my invitation for you to give us and everybody listening 3 claps, followed by the words, boom, shakalaka. You got it, man? Ready?
I got it. I love it. Yeah, man.
All right, dude. Breaking us out into our day here on episode 10 of season 2 of High Performance Pathways, my friend, fellow brother in arms, John. John, break down on 3. 1, 2, 3.
Boom, shakalaka. All right, brother. My breakdown is this, that we are all here on this third rock from the sun, floating around in space together. I implore you to all look for ways to serve your neighbors, serve your friends, serve your family, but also to look for ways to serve complete strangers, because it is incredible what you can find when you're out there serving others. And not only what you can find in those others that you're serving, but also what you can find in yourself. And you will never regret serving those others, and you will never regret finding what you find in yourself in doing so. Also, don't forget, in order to serve others, you have to take care of yourself. So that comes full circle back to what we were talking about earlier, you can't take care of others if you don't take care of yourself. Make sure you're taking care of yourself. So that's my breakdown for you all. I really enjoyed being on the show. Court, thanks for the opportunity, man. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, man, you're the best, dude. Wonderful breakdown. Appreciate it. Thanks for being here. Hey, everybody, to find John, check him out on LinkedIn, John McCaskill. And hey, don't worry. It's one of the hardest names I could ever spell in the way that it's said. But I'm going to spell it for you. But when you look for his handle, you're looking for John, and that's J-O-N. And I'll spell the last name M-A-C-A-S-K-I-L-L. And then you also need to put in deputy executive director and CFO. If you get all that in there in the search bar, you got my man, John. Or, hey, just go check out Veterans Path. Search it up. Hey, John, what handles podcast-wise can we find Veterans Path?
Yeah, it's pretty easy. We are on Apple Podcasts. We're on Spotify. We're on Breaker. We're on all the major podcast platforms, and it's just Veterans Path. If you look us up as Veterans Path, you'll find the episodes there. And we've had some amazing guests on there, from Olympic gold medalists to Navy Cross recipients to some women who have just been unbelievable mothers and examples of growth and recovery from military sexual trauma. So it's been an amazing experience running that podcast and learning about the different guest backgrounds. Veterans Path, just on all the different major podcast platforms.
Awesome, man. Thanks for that. And hey, y'all, here's my charge, building off of John's breakdown. It's really pretty simple. Get your tails out there. And consider what John shared and chase high performance in your own life. Later.